You are listening to a sermon by Michelle Drewitz, recorded on Sunday, June 15, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I just want to say thank you for the invitation to preach this morning. It's a privilege to be here. I also wanted to say happy Father's Day. It is Father's Day, so happy Father's Day to fathers, uncles, grandfathers, and those who play a fatherly role in someone's life.
Thank you. Hope,
and if you have a father, you should phone them today at some point. So based on the lectionary reading for this week, I will be focusing on Genesis 1 and 2, on what it means to be created in the image of God. The passage has already been read, so I won't be reading that again in the interest of time. But before we explore what it means to be created in the image of God, I just wanted to highlight a few things about the book of Genesis that might be helpful as we look at image of God. It's generally understood that Moses is the author of Genesis, and the audience is the covenant community of God, so it's the Israelites in the wilderness. It's unclear whether or not Moses authored Genesis 1 to 2 because of the structural patterns that the creation story holds with Babylonian texts. Moses probably would not have been aware of those at that time. Needless to say, it doesn't really matter who authored Genesis 1 and 2. It doesn't influence how we read it or our understanding of it. The Hebrew understanding of the word Genesis refers to beginning, and the Greek understanding of the word Genesis refers to origin and creation. So the genre of Genesis 1 to 2 is cosmology. It addresses the origins of the cosmos. It establishes a worldview. It helps us to understand how the world works, how it came to be that way, our function in the world. So Genesis is to the Israelites what science is to us in our current culture. But perhaps more importantly, Genesis describes what it means to be the people of God and to be in relation to our Creator God. Genesis 1 to 2 clearly articulates that the Creator God is the Lord of Israel's history. It's an assertion of God's transcendence and immanence, a placement of God as ruler and sovereign within the covenant community of Israel. So instead of learning about science or history, we learn about God through the creation story. What does creation mean in Genesis? What does it mean to create or to be created? In the ancient world, something is created when it has a function, a role, a purpose, something that it can do. The Hebrew verb for create focuses on the functional existence, not on the material existence. So something doesn't exist because it has molecules and matter. Something exists because it has a function, something to do, a role to play. It's helpful to remember this as we read Genesis. It isn't a description of what exists so much as a description of how things exist. There are different ways of giving functionality to something, including naming and differentiating. Genesis does both. But it is Yahweh alone who is the one who names and differentiates. So Yahweh gives function. Something is brought into existence in Genesis through Yahweh. Biblical scholars agree that fundamental to Genesis, to the creation account, and fundamental to the entire biblical worldview, is that humanity is created in the image of God. Nowhere in any other ancient texts or creation accounts does this hold true. Humans just aren't regarded as being in the creation of God. So being created in the image of God sets the entire human race, male and female, masters and slaves, rich and poor, separate from other creatures. What does it mean to image something? To image something doesn't mean to be a copycat or exact representation. It's not a facsimile. An image seeks to represent and to express. It holds qualities and attributes and characteristics of the one being represented. So humanity is not equal to God, but an adequate representation of God. God is not made like us, but we are made like God. So we are theomorphic. There are divine attributes bestowed on humanity. In contrast, in the ancient Near East, the image of God is equated with the God itself. It's important to note that in the Bible, there's the use of likeness. So again, we're reminded that we are image bearers, but we are not God. We are like God. Humanity is both godlike and creature. So to adequately understand the impact and significance of Genesis 1 to 2, I want to contrast Genesis with the ancient Near Eastern worldview and understanding of creation. To begin with, I'll explore the relationship between God and the cosmos. Then I'll talk about the relationship between God and humanity. And finally, I'll examine the relationship between humanity and the cosmos. Integrated throughout, I'll address the role of image bearer and seek to demonstrate just how radical and profound it is that we bear the image of God. So God and cosmos. In the ancient Near East worldview, the cosmos existed for the benefit of the gods. The world was created for the gods. The cosmos did not exist for humans or for creatures or for anything else. Because this cosmos centered around the gods, everything existed for the gods. Cities were built for gods. Temples were the houses for the gods. Humans were for the gods as well. Humans were there to feed the gods and to meet the needs of the gods. So with this understanding in mind, images of gods were important to remind people of the place of the deity. So an image of a god was placed in a temple to indicate the presence of a god in a temple. In Genesis, the worldview sets out a very different relationship between Yahweh and the cosmos. Instead of the world being created for the gods, Yahweh creates the cosmos for the creatures, for animals, for plants, and for humans, for life to flourish and fill the earth. Yahweh does not create the cosmos for his benefit or to satisfy his needs. Things don't exist for Yahweh, but things exist for each other. The Israelite temple also contrasted from the temples of the ancient Near East. There were no images, no idols or statues of Yahweh inside the temple. This is because Yahweh's house is not the temple. The entire cosmos is Yahweh's temple. And so drawing on the parallel of having a deity's image in a temple that represents the presence of the deity, it's clear that the human presence in the world indicates the presence of Yahweh. As Ian Proven writes, humans are not caretakers of a divine image in a temple, then they are themselves divine images in a temple. Wherever humanity is, there is the image of Yahweh. So in sum, Genesis 1 presents a world created by Yahweh in which life can flourish. The ancient Near East presents a world so that gods can flourish. Secondly, what is the relationship between God and humanity? In the ancient Near East, because creation centered around the gods, humanity was created out of necessity for the gods. They existed to serve the gods, to feed them. Humans were an afterthought in creation, not an intentional or purposeful act in creating. In effect, humans were slave labor for the gods. The only human who was allowed to do the work of the gods was the king. And so because of the divine status of the king, kings represented a particular god in a city-state. Kings were the only ones who carried the image of a deity because the image held the source of the king's power and prerogative. So in the ancient Near East, kings were the only ones who were viewed as the image of a deity. In addition, kings would often set up images of themselves throughout their territory to show how much land that they had possessed and conquered. The biblical account of the relationship between Yahweh and humans has some similarities and also important differences as well. Unlike the ancient Near East, humanity does not exist as slave labor to keep Yahweh alive. It's true that humanity serves Yahweh, but not as slave labor. We don't take care of Yahweh, Yahweh takes care of us. We don't feed Yahweh, Yahweh feeds us. The importance of humans in relation to Yahweh is further emphasized in how humans are formed. Humans are created out of dust. In the ancient Near East, gods were also created out of dust. So the way in which humanity is created and given life has echoes of how gods were created. Proven says, like the images of the gods in the ancient world, human beings are, in biblical thinking, made from dust and yet destined for glory. So the creation account builds up to the creation of humanity. It isn't as though the creation of humanity is a low point or afterthought. It's intentional and purposeful. Psalm 8, which already was read, sums up the relationship between Yahweh and humanity. And I'll read it again. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babies and infants, you have established strength because of your foes to still the enemy and the avenger. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. So from Psalm 8, we also note that even after sin and moral evil enter the world, we are created in the image of God and bear his likeness. Finally, like the ancient Near East, it's understood that the image bearer does the work of God. But in the Bible, every human being bears the image of God, not just the king. So all humans, male and female, slave and master, rich and poor, young and old, do Yahweh's work. In sum, all humans bear the image of Yahweh and share in the work. In the ancient Near East, humans functioned to keep the gods alive, and only the king was permitted to do the work of the gods. Thirdly, what's the relationship between humanity and the cosmos? In the ancient Near East, humanity had little relationship with the rest of creation or the cosmos. As I mentioned earlier, their primary function was to serve the needs of the gods, to feed and do work necessary for the existence of the gods. And because kings were the only image bearers of the divine, kings were the only ones with the power and prerogative to rule the cosmos. But in contrast, in Genesis, the cosmos is created for creatures, and the cosmos cannot function or exist without humans. Humanity is critical to the well-being and flourishing of the cosmos. This doesn't mean that humans sustain the cosmos. Only God alone sustains the cosmos. But humans do have a vital function in relationship to the cosmos. Ian Provan puts it well when he says that creation does not function biblically without the human beings who are placed within it to rule over it. So this means that every person, you and I, share in the work of Yahweh because we all bear the image of Yahweh. Genesis 1:26 and 1:28 give function and purpose to humanity. We are created to have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So humanity's role is twofold: to rule creation and to fill creation. We are not to take care of gods, but we are to take care of creation. The Hebrew words referring to rule and subdue have kingship and military echoes. It doesn't mean that we exploit and abuse and corrupt. Rather, kingship and military conquest is an act of justice. Ian Provan explains that dominion is much better understood as a sacrificial looking after creation. It's an aspect of our being created in God's image that human beings should imitate God in his creativity and in his providential care for creatures. So creation needs to be subdued, cared for, served, and kept. These roles are exercised by humans as humanity brings order to the world. In our day, this might be called conservation or worm composting. But having dominion is more than taking care of creation. It includes arts and science. It's a cultural mandate. As image bearers, humans hold a kingly ruler position and a priestly servant role. Our function is both priestly and religious. And so the declaration in Genesis that all humans, not just kings, are to rule would have markedly differed from ancient Near Eastern perception of human ruling. Another point I just want to briefly mention is that it seems our function can only be exercised fully in community. We cannot rule individually, but there has to be community. Both male and female are made in the image of God. So subsequently, both male and female fulfill the role of image bearer, to rule and to have dominion. Men and women rule together and rule separately. A man can fulfill a role, so can a woman. So there's a noticeable equality between man and women. There's no power difference or hierarchy. Again, this would have been very different from the ancient Near Eastern perspective. All are image bearers, and both men and women are placed in the garden to rule. So one way we see this dominion and ruling playing out is through the naming of animals. You'll recall that naming is a significant part of creation because naming helps to bring functionality to something. In Genesis 2, when Adam, or the earthling, names the animals, it demonstrates that Adam joins with God in the creation of the world. Adam helps to give function or rules to the other creation. So the naming process identifies primarily their role and place in the world rather than an identification of what they are. In Genesis 1, it is Yahweh giving name and order to the world. In Genesis 2, the earthling, the image of God, helps to give name and order to the world. So in sum, the ancient Near East presents a world in which humans are created to serve the gods and only kings can do the work of the divine. But in contrast, Genesis 2 presents a world created by Yahweh in which humans are essential to the flourishing of life. I think it's important to note that although we all bear the image of God, we are not the perfect image of God. The perfect image of God is found in Christ alone. Colossians 1:15-20 reads, "Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross." So to tie these three themes together, God and cosmos, God and humanity, and humanity and cosmos, Waelke writes that being made in God's image establishes humanity's role on earth and facilitates communication with the divine. Bearing God's image gives us a function within the world and in relation to God. Waelke suggests that understanding that we are made in the image of God is essential for understanding our destiny and relationship to God. The most powerful of all spiritual forces is a person's view of themselves, the way in which they understand their nature and destiny. Indeed, it is the one force which determines all the other which influence human life. So as we can see, grasping this image of God stuff is critical to our living, to how we live, to our choices, to our relationship with God, with others, and with ourselves. So when we understand that we are created in the image of God, it changes how we relate to our Creator. We serve and love God by caring for all his creation. When we understand that each person is created in the image of God, it changes how we relate to others. We treat others with respect, dignity, equality, and love because they also bear the image of God. We represent God to others. And when we understand ourselves as image bearers, it changes our identity by giving us function and purpose. We understand why we are created. Thank you.